In 2013, Florida had the highest number of newly diagnosed HIV cases in the nation. The Tampa Bay and Central Florida metro regions each saw more new cases than two dozen other states. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at BayCareEvents.org.
I'm Carson Cooper, on location in Selby Auditorium at the University of South Florida, Sarasota, Manatee, for a town hall edition of Florida Matters. All six major metropolitan areas in Florida, including Tampa, Orlando, and Miami-Dade, reported more cases of HIV diagnosis than many whole states. Health News Florida, which focuses on the health issues for WUSF Public Media, reported on this in a recent series of reports called HIV in Florida, The Rising Tide of Infection. You can hear the entire series, HIV in Florida, The Rising Tide of Infection, at WUSFnews.org. Now, so many of our listeners responded to this series that a town hall meeting like this one was the next logical step. And we've got a great audience here at Selby Auditorium at USF Sarasota Manatee, and we'll take questions and comments during the second half of the show. But let's say hello to our guests now. Debbie Sergilaws is a peer navigator at Sarasota's Comprehensive Care Clinic and has been HIV positive since 1989. Dr. Vilma Vega is an internist and infectious disease HIV specialist with Infectious Disease Associates in Sarasota. And Mary Shedden is the editor of Health News Florida and newly minted news director at WUSF. Welcome. Glad you could be here today. Mary, I'm going to start with you first with the question that was on many of our minds after we heard the series. Why are HIV rates in Florida higher than any other state?
There are a couple of different reasons that people are pointing to. First, Florida's the third largest state, so we're going to have more numbers just by the number of people in the state. But by comparison, we had almost 2,000 more than the state of New York. Another reason is age. We are an aging state. We're a little older, and a lot of individuals who are living with HIV are 50 plus. And then also there are questions about prevention efforts here in the state, how they're targeting different populations.
Mm-hmm. I want to dig into demographics in a moment, but Debbie Sergilaws, you were diagnosed with HIV in 1989. You and your first husband were ready to start a family. He goes in for blood work and you think nothing of it. And then what happened?
Yes, we were actually wanting to have a baby, and so my husband tried to get life insurance. We found out on the telephone that his HIV test came back positive. We weren't even aware that he was tested at that time, and the ball started rolling from that point, not really knowing where to turn or what to do. This, at that point, was not considered an illness that was gotten by heterosexuals. And so we never thought it could happen to us. And that same question, that same situation occurs today. And it still worries me to the fact that people believe it can't happen to them. I was married. I was trying to have a baby. It happened to me. It really, the bottom line is how you present yourself as far as if you get exposed by somebody else's sexual fluids or blood. If that person has HIV, your risk is right there. It does not have to be high risk. It just needs to be a risk of someone else's body fluids that you get infected by.
Now, this was 1989, and when you and your husband both got that positive diagnosis, your first question was?
First question was, when are we going to die? That's what we knew about HIV. And they didn't have an answer for us. I guess I'm glad about that. I am still here some, 25 plus years later to be able to talk about it and spread the message. Unfortunately, my husband died in 1993, and he had just turned 40 years old. So many of us aren't here to continue to speak and to spread the message. And I hope to be able to do that for many, many more years.
Dr. Vilma Vega, the late 80s, a time when that diagnosis was a death sentence, wasn't it?
Correct, correct. I mean, I was in medical school at that time, and I was seeing HIV patients, but we didn't recognize it as HIV back then. It was gay immune-related disorder, and that's how it showed up on the morbidity and mortality world reports. So, you know, we started seeing these sort of patients and didn't have a name for it, and we thought it was amongst gay patients until we began to realize that in Haiti there were patients that were showing up that were females. And, of course, after I went from medical school there, I trained in Miami, which is the biggest capital in HIV back then. It was probably the second highest area of HIV. So 9 out of 10 of my admissions in the hospital were HIV positive with some severe diseases. And so we were treating almost like a hospice group instead of a disease that we could really treat.
Mm-hmm. Mary Shedden, talk to us about demographics. Where do most of the cases of HIV show up these days?
Well, about half of all new cases are still in the groups of men who are having sex with men and HIV drug users. But that's not describing who is getting infected. You're talking about young people. A huge number of new cases are coming from young people who are ages 13 to 24. The older population, 50 plus, 23% of Floridians diagnosed in 2013 were 50 and older. This doesn't fit into one stereotype. It is old, it is young, it is gay, it is straight. The transgender community is significantly at risk as well as the African-American community is still very affected by it.
Debbie, there's always been a stigma associated with AIDS and HIV, and you set out on a mission years ago to convince women to seek help. Many were afraid of losing jobs, family rejection, shame, and public perception. Are those still big roadblocks, especially to women these days?
Definitely. They are continuing to hold people back from getting care, getting diagnosed. They are afraid. People are afraid to find out if they have HIV. And many will just stick their head in the sand and go about their way feeling like they don't have any problems. They're a good person. They're a clean person. They feel good. So why do they need to get tested? Stigma plays a big part in that. Many of us who do speak out and speak up about being HIV positive feel discriminated against. I lost a nursing job in the process of disclosing my status. I was refused dental care when I disclosed my status. To my knowledge, I haven't lost friends, but I know people, and I have women in my support group. I help to facilitate a support group at Community AIDS Network. I would say over 90% of those women are not out and open about their status. And these are women that still come into our clinic with sunglasses, hoodies over their heads, wigs, and are afraid to be seen, afraid to be related to going into a building that treats people with HIV. We don't even have the word AIDS on our building, but these women are afraid to come for support and in turn medical care because of the stigma and the discrimination that we're still seeing here in 2015.
Dr. Vega, were those legitimate concerns, though, among the medical community? You said dentistry, Debbie, you wouldn't see a dentist wouldn't see you. Were those were concerns, though, because there was so little was known about HIV and how it was transmitted?
Correct. As a matter of fact, that was a big change even in Sarasota when one of the first HIV clinics started here. And you know, that was the reason, was because the stigma of the medical community. And I still remember the times when, I went to medical school in Rockford, Illinois, a little town, and people who did not know much about anything that had to do with infectious disease treated it like a level 4 with their whole hazmat, you know, the whole concern of how am I going to catch this. And it's changed so much. And it's brilliant the way that now the medical community does here in Sarasota. They have tremendously changed. And I do believe it's because it has to do with the HIV clinics in this area, how they have gone on to change the face of HIV, and hopefully programs like this as well.
We don't hear a lot about blood transfusions these days, but back then that was a big deal. Blood transfusions were responsible for a number of HIV and AIDS cases.
Correct. That's why the Ryan White issue came on in that name, is because of that and the hemophiliacs.
Has the virus changed any since it was first discovered? Is it transmitted in the same ways? Has it mutated over the years? Or is it the exact same virus that you were looking at back in 1990?
Well, it's transmitted in the same way, but the viruses obviously do mutate. The concern, obviously, is the development of a more resistant virus. And then when condoms are not used, when people acquire disease, now it can be anywhere between 6 to 15% of people who actually acquire a resistant virus. And some very serious ones, like the one up in New York, which was resistant to everything except in an injection form of medication.
Mary Shedden, public health educators preach the importance of testing, and there's a National HIV Testing Day every June. Is testing for HIV routine when we get blood work, say, for a checkup?
It is in some cases, but not all doctors. And I defer to Dr. Vega, and she's nodding, so this is a good thing. We're on radio, so I have to describe that. But a lot of doctors don't just naturally assume it, but it is something that's included. The Affordable Care Act included it as part of preventative care. It is something that people are still encouraged to make sure that their doctor is getting that test when you're doing routine blood work. It doesn't take any more blood. It's just asking one more question. And it's an important question because especially the symptoms of HIV really don't present for almost a decade. And so that's a real concern because you may be living with it and sharing it with others long, long before you might know you're infected.
Yeah, it's virtually, you just don't know you have it in many cases. And David, let me ask you about that. The fact that HIV is not a death sentence these days, it's manageable with drugs. Does that lead to complacency, do you believe, among some patients?
Definitely. I mean, I think we are all thrilled that we can take one pill and live a normal life with a chronic disease. I really have a hard time with that normal chronic disease because living with HIV will never be normal. It does not mean you have to get sick. And in fact, if we are diagnosing early with early testing and then treating early, we can prevent someone from getting sick. My concern with the one pill a day and that people think now it is easy is such a big thing because that one pill a day is a combination of very toxic medications. It has a lot of side effects. One of the hardest things for myself right now, living with this for so long, is I have taken 16 different combinations of HIV medications. Those affected my body in very different ways, and they continue to affect me. So if someone thinks that taking a pill that can cost up to $1,000 to $3,000 a month is easy, then I'd like to sit down and have a conversation with them because I want to find out how that's so easy.
Now, you aggressively sought out treatment early on. 1999, you traveled to Russia.
Yes.
To seek treatment not available in the U.S. What was that, and did it work, and is it now available in the U.S.?
Well, it was a trip of a lifetime, I have to say. And it was funded by the United Nations. We went and had, it turned out to be magnetic therapy. My physician, infectious disease doctor local here, basically said, go ahead, you'll have a nice trip. I don't think it'll hurt you, but I don't think it'll help you. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what had occurred. But I was willing at that time, we were just seeing protease inhibitors coming out, and that was a turning point in people living a much longer, healthier life with HIV. And I was searching for anything. I saw my husband die from complications of AIDS. And I didn't want to go down that same road. And I saw so many of my friends dying. A week wouldn't go by without going to at least one funeral for many, many, many years. We're not seeing that now. And that's wonderful, but I think that goes and plays into the complacency that people think this is a chronic, manageable, normal illness that you can deal with. and it's not quite that easy.
Dr. Vega, are researchers hot on the heels of a cure? Where are we with HIV right now?
Well, I think we're still quite a ways away from an actual vaccine. I mean, there's been some early vaccine trials that have shown some promise, but again, it's in varied populations. And certainly I don't think it's going to be produced anytime soon to be actually out there for treatment. And I think the importance is exactly what Debbie says, which is complacency is really what needs to be dealt with. Education, the importance of testing. And that means not only from the physician or healthcare community, but also from the patients. I think it's important that we be aggressive. There's actually no stipulation at this point that we have to have a consent. There's actually an opt-out formulation for your HIV testing, which means any physician can test you. You can opt out, but it's not necessary that a physician require a written consent. So that's important to know. And for you guys, there are many physicians who are not aware of the need to test you, but need to understand everyone should be tested. If you've had sex once in your life, if you've had a blood transfusion, if you've had any sort of contact, IV drug use, anything like that, you need to get tested. I don't care if it's one time. I don't care if you're 90 years of age. And you have to understand that the population of my patients with HIV in this area runs around an average age of 55. My oldest is 92, all right? And he acquired it sexually. So you need to realize that, yes, this disease is not going to be going away. The treatments are still, they're going to be coming out here and there. But I'll tell you, it's still not going to be some miracle cure that's going to come around even within the next 7 years, possibly.
Do you believe U.S. patent laws holding back a cure? Drug companies may have little incentive to develop new drugs because a 20-year patent often expires before clinical trials are complete, so they wouldn't make much money from a drug that's been approved. So should the patent clock start at the end of clinical trials?
Right. Well, you know what, Carson, I really cannot speak about the laws of the pharmaceutical industry, and it would be very difficult and very wrong, I think, for me to comment regarding that. But I do believe that we have to be more aggressive with the research. I agree. There has to be more in actual treatment and cure of a disease. I think, like anything else, unfortunately, out there, when there is little money to be had in certain areas, there's going to be less and less money for research and development.
You're listening to Florida Matters on location in Sarasota at USF Sarasota Manatee for a town hall meeting on the rising tide of HIV in Florida. Next, questions from our audience.
We're dealing with some social amnesia, so how do we as a community address this?
I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. This is Florida Matters. I'm Carson Cooper, and we're on location in Selby Auditorium at USF Sarasota Manatee for a town hall meeting on the rising tide of HIV in Florida. Our guests are Debbie Sergilaz, a peer navigator at Sarasota's Comprehensive Care Clinic and HIV patient, Dr. Vilma Vega with Infectious Disease Associates in Sarasota, and Mary Shedden, editor of Health News Florida. And we are devoting this segment of our show to questions from our audience. We'll turn it over to our first audience member.
Hi, my name is Evan Michael. I'm with CARES Outreach Services, and in coordination with USF Sarasota Manatee, we actually have our mobile unit outside doing testing today for anybody who wants to know their status. My question is for Dr. Vega. Is it plausible that the possibility exists for somebody, once they find out they are positive, if they change their lifestyle in such a way where they start eating better, living better, more for their self, like just being selflessly selfish, almost, you know, saying no to the activities that they know are promiscuous and dangerous, if they just lived better and were better individuals, is it possible that they would even need to start the medication? Is it possible that they can combat the adverse effects of living with HIV and AIDS by just living better? Are the medicines, I mean, I know it's preached that the medicines are necessary, but is it plausible that they're not necessary for all?
Well, we need to understand that now HIV, 30 years later, you're talking about so much years of going back and forth. We've had all these philosophies. We've had philosophies of waiting until CD4 counts drop below 200. We've had philosophies of waiting into, you know, all, like I said, not to treating for a long time, not treating non-progressors. But what has shown over time clearly is that we've gone back the pendulum all the way back to the beginning, which is the treatment for all. And I don't want to tell you that there isn't a possibility that there may be a handful of patients, but I'm going to have to lean on the fact of you've got to really be on treatment. If you are HIV positive, the treatments are out there. The fact that the earlier you get, clearly, when you have primary HIV infection, in that window of opportunity where you've got your first 3 to 6 months at which you've acquired the disease, it is clear that if we can save your immune system, your natural immune system, which you were born with, for the longest amount of time as possible, then it's better. The possibility of whether you're one of those rare people is so hard to say that it would be impossible and would be wrong for me to say that, yes, you know, you could be one of those people. But the fact of it is, it's clear. You want to prevent long-term disease. You want to prevent heart disease. You want to prevent cancers. And all of these things are mutations that can occur in your body when a virus is running rampant. And it doesn't matter whether or not you are at low detectable viral loads or whether you are at millions of viral load. It can still affect you long-term and can kind of release those other diseases so that you may get those diseases earlier in your lifetime.
Great question. Next.
Yes, hi. This is Dr. Lisa Merritt from the Multicultural Health Institute. And I first want to applaud the panel for such an excellent and informative discussion. We need more of this. Having grown up more or less professionally in the epidemic, starting my training at San Francisco General in the early 80s, and we're dealing with some social amnesia. You have young people and physicians as well who don't, like me, remember the horrors of watching just young men, mostly at that time, just waste away and die before our eyes with nothing that we could do for them. And so that's not as compelling an image. We're glad that we've made that progress. But however, it has led to a real challenge, like Dr. Vega and the others are mentioning, with the denial and the ability to attempt to ignore this. So how do we as a community address this, push the leadership to provide the funding and the true directive to deal with these issues?
Dr. Vega?
Right. I think the number one way is to continue to push the message of testing and prevention in all different manners. But especially, I say, education that has to be out in the community through forums, through public media. My concern, Dr. Merritt, is exactly in part what you say, the increase in heroin use. We clearly know, and I obviously see this in the hospital with various infections that we have, which have tremendously gone up in the last, I would say, 6 to 10 years as far as IV drug use infection. And I'm not talking about HIV. I'm talking about regular other types. But my concern is all it's going to require is a few of these patients who also acquire HIV. And now HIV is going to be quite rampant in this area. So we are actually have just begun to see that pinnacle. I have not yet seen the HIV transmission in IV drug use as high, but all it takes is a few, and it's going to grow tremendously like rapid fire here in this area. So I am concerned. I'm concerned that we need to be fighting more than just sexual transmission, but IV drug use. And we have to be testing every patient and really, you know, getting out there, like I said, in the media to show. I mean, this is the reason why I agreed to do this program. And it's been some of the reasons why I believe that we are ourselves, you know, as physicians, advocates for prevention. But yes, you guys are as well. Anybody who works in the HIV world, anyone who has HIV, you know, that is something that, although very difficult at times, is required to be able to get out there and speak in forums. And I would say that same for Highland community. If one can get into those areas where you're speaking to public council, to other agencies where you can put on forums to educate more and more, that will catch on.
My name is Paul. The thing that's interesting to me is more and more teenagers are not identifying strictly as straight. in this recent studies, we up to 23% are saying that they vary in partners. And with this, the chance of the transmission of the HIV virus is much more possible. And I'm thinking, why aren't we taking better use of social media like YouTube and forums like that and Facebook and so to get the message out? Because if you can't use the school districts because of conservatism and different kinds of things, there are things that teenagers do access all the time where they get their information from, which are much more effective. I'm just asking.
I can tell you this. I've got teenagers. Facebook is not on their radar at all these days. They've moved well beyond that. Mary Shedden?
One of the stories in our series actually was focusing on that 13 to 24 demographic that's being infected. And it actually speaks to the doctor's question as well about how do we talk to these different communities. Really, the HIV prevention message needs to be tailored to everyone. It needs to be on social media, so other than Facebook, that's reaching out to the young people. It needs to be in the senior centers, talking about the fact that, great, you can't get pregnant anymore, but you still need protection. And I think a global education message just doesn't work. And I think that's just saying no isn't enough.
I think disclosure, someone who's HIV positive and not disclosing their status, not having the capability to share that information, even with the closest people that they're with, and then maybe their sexual partners. And we go back to the stigma and the discrimination, which then blocks the ability for someone to choose to disclose their status. And until we have people who are HIV positive speaking up, standing up for who we are as persons that have a disease process, we should not be looked at as someone who has a terrible thing called AIDS. We need to be looked at as one of you, as equals. And if we all look at each other as if we could be HIV positive, I think we can reduce our transmission rate significantly in all age groups. Thank you.
Debbie Sergilaws, a peer navigator at Sarasota's Comprehensive Care Clinic and HIV patient, Dr. Vilma Vega with Infectious Disease Associates in Sarasota, and Mary Shedden, editor of Health News Florida at WUSF Public Media. And you can hear our entire series, HIV in Florida, The Rising Tide of Infection, at WUSFnews.org. And we welcome your comments, questions, and feedback on our Facebook page. Thanks to USF Sarasota Manatee for allowing us to hold this Florida Matters Town Hall meeting here today. And thanks to our great audience here today. Thank you so much. Florida Matters is produced by Lottie Watts. Our remote engineer is Dustin Hapley, and our show is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.